This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Nearly 50 people stood in the chilly winds along Airport Road at the Gary Chicago International Airport entrance on Friday morning, chanting and holding up signs in protest of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement deportation flights out of the airport. The vigil was organized by Northwest Indiana Resistance, a group that co-organizer Ruth Needleman says was formed to help coordinate activities, bring different groups together, end the deportations, raise money, and try to get some welcoming city ordinances passed by some of the local communities. Reverend Charles Streidelmeyer, the pastor of the Augustana Lutheran Church in Hobart, was a co-organizer, and he was one of the first speakers at the vigil and rally on Friday.
We're going to start now with a word of prayer. And then we're going to need some chants, and so we're going to have to practice a little bit. So this is choir rehearsal, folks. Let's open with a word of prayer. Lord, we are all made in your image. We are all precious in your sight. We are made to love and to relate to one another. We are there to feel one another's pain and to help each other in trouble. Take what we offer you now and use it for the well-being of those who are despised. Make us instruments of your peace. And it is for your mercy that we pray. Amen. All right, are you ready to make some noise? Let's see how loud we can be. No ban, no wall, justice for all.
No ban! No wall, justice for all. No ban, no wall, justice for all. No ban, no wall, justice for all. No ban, no wall, justice for all.
All right.
Gary Common Councilwoman Regan Hatcher talked to the crowd about efforts by the City Council to make Gary more inclusive and supportive of immigrants.
Now we're working on passing an ordinance to make Gary a welcoming city. We know that it'll be great to know the history of Gary and the history of the civil rights movement that happened right here in the city of Gary. It's difficult to see what's happening now at the airport. When my father first got on the city council back in 1964, African Americans were only allowed to live in the central area of Gary, not in Glen Park or Miller or Horseman or any of those surrounding areas. And it was he and that city council that led the fight to allow all people to be able to live wherever they want to in this city. And when he was mayor, the airport was kind of, you know, his dream to see it be a flourishing airport one day. And after talking to him, he's just disgusted to learn that ICE is deporting people from this airport with the history of our city. So we're working on a welcoming ordinance, and we're hoping that we have the support, I think we do, for it to pass. And we know that Trump is making big threats against cities who want to welcome in immigrants for a safe place and a protected place to live. So we're not necessarily calling it a sanctuary city, but we're calling it a welcoming city. And so part of that, hopefully one day we get to sanctuary status. But in the meantime, just to be able to stop the deportation of immigrants from this location in Gary would be a huge victory and success towards that.
The group, by the way, is meeting with Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson today about the ordinance. Another speaker, another minister in Gary, took the microphone of the portable PA system and talked about what she called the injustice of the nation's current immigration policies.
I stand here today opposed to the heavy-handed, inhumane deportation policies that are tearing apart families. I stand here today because injustice against one is injustice against all. If we sit quietly and watch as ICE removes innocent people from their homes, people who work hard every day to provide a decent life for their families, people whose only crime was believing that coming to these yet united to be states would be
providing for them a better way of life. People who believe that they too deserve a home in the land of the free and the home of the brave. If we continue to sit quietly and watch as ICE destroys these homes and families, the day will soon come when ICE or their equivalent will be knocking at our doors as well. We must be diligent in our fight to reject the Trump administration's reckless and inhumane deportation agenda by working to establish state laws that ensure that our state and local resources are not used to deport families. We must stand and we must fight. We must demand that bed quotas be done away with. Bed quotas that require ICE to hold daily an average of 34,000 people. Individuals in detention centers across this country, detention centers like GEO that we fought against in this community. But it's a fight that we know will soon come again with this Trump administration. Since its establishment in 2009, the bed quota continually rises. ICE is the only enforcement agency subject to a quota on the number of individuals they must hold in detention. We must fight to end bed quotas. Trump is now unleashing ICE to patrol areas of public life that were normally off limits for immigration enforcement. They are now lurking behind schools, hospitals, and places of worship. Victims of violent and physical crimes are dropping their cases for fear that testifying in court will expose them to deportation. Educators across the country are reporting a drop in school attendance, and health clinics report that immigrants are removing themselves from health care programs. But ICE cannot work in isolation. About 70% of all deportations nationwide are the result of local law enforcement's participation in federal immigration activities. ICE needs local law enforcement to work. And without their assistance, the Trump administration cannot continue with their deportation program. We must force our local police officials not to get involved.
Quincy Worthington, the pastor of the Munster Presbyterian Church, also spoke to the crowd on Friday morning. He started his remarks with a personal note.
You know, I'm here today because in scriptures, when somebody asks Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" These are our neighbors. And when Jesus asks us how to treat people, he says we need to treat the least of these with the same precious treatment that we would treat anyone. You know, I stand up here today because I'm a father of four kids.
So I stand up here for my kids, that we might make this country and this world something that they can be proud of.
Yeah.
I stand up here for your kids. Stand up here for the kids of those who are coming here to be deported. Stand up here for all of God's children. The truth is that my freedom is bound in your freedom, and your freedom is bound in the persons next to you. That my opportunities in this country are solely dependent on your opportunities. That my humanness is bound in your humanness, and your humanness is bound in the person next to you. We are sewn together in a single garment of destiny, of humanity. And it then becomes, for me as a Christian, a religious obligation, but for all of us, it's a moral obligation to stand against injustice. Because as Dr. King told us, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere. And so we have an obligation to be here today, to stand up against injustice, to give voice to those who are voiceless, to give hope to those who are hopeless, to stand for people who cannot stand for themselves. Because we believe in ideals and in a kingdom that's better than what we are now. And this country was founded and dreamed upon to be what better than what it is now.
As the speeches continued, the wind whistling around the microphone of the PA system, the protesters then noted two unmarked buses, the windows covered up to prevent anyone looking in or looking out. As they approached on the airport road headed to the Gary Jet Center, the People stopped speaking and they started chanting.
No man! No wall! Justice for all! Justice for all! Justice for all!
The buses would have turned in front of the crowd, but instead went further up Airport Road to another airport entrance. A small group of protesters soon left the spot where they gathered and walked down to the fence and gate that separated the parking lot from the airport runways. And Reverend Streetlemeyer argued with some of that group members about their decision to break away.
You create unnecessary problems.
There's a problem that they have people captive and they're going to take them away. That's the problem.
And this is not going to solve it if we go out on the airport. It is simply going to make it harder for us to do things like this. We have been organizing for years. We know what we're doing.
It doesn't work. So do we. And that's why everyone chose to come out. It was a group decision.
Exactly. I understand this, but I also understand that we cannot break discipline. We are prepared to do what is necessary.
Apparently
but you
not.
Plan first. You plan first.
This was planned. We made the decision over there and then walked over there. It was a plan.
On the spur of the moment.
Ruth Needleman said that the protest was not about the airport, but about the flights of undocumented immigrants flying out of the facility, an act that was allowed because of a compact signed years ago between then-Gary Mayor Thomas Barnes and then-Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. She says the group supports economic growth in Gary to return the airport to profitability. She said at the rally that no jobs are being created by the deportations by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Gary Chicago International Airport spokesman David Goldenberg told the Times that ICE hires operators around the country to handle the deportations, and the Gary Airport has no involvement other than meeting its obligation under the agreement to receive federal funding to keep the airport operating. Reverend Streetlemeyer has experience in organizing protests like this. He set up the protests against the GEO Group's twice-canceled plans for building an ICE detention center in northwest Indiana, first in Hobart and later in Gary. Colleges and universities these days are tackling a big issue, whether to officially adopt policies that are intended to protect people who entered the United States illegally. In Indiana, that conversation, though, could soon end. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Peter Ballin and Rosen reports the controversy surrounds a single word.
Some Indiana lawmakers want to outlaw so-called sanctuary campuses. They're colleges that say they won't help immigration authorities learn someone's citizenship status. And it's using that word, sanctuary, and making that pledge, that's the big deal.
It's just the schools couldn't sponsor sanctuary situations.
Republican Representative Woody Burton is House sponsor of a controversial bill at the State House. It would ban colleges from pledging non-cooperation with immigration authorities. If they do, the state would be able to file civil suits, and a court could force them to cooperate.
Indiana needs to abide by federal laws when it comes to immigration issues in general.
Since the Trump administration made crackdowns on unauthorized immigrants central to its agenda, colleges and universities have been in the crosshairs. Students and faculty have pushed for sanctuary campuses at places including University of Notre Dame and Purdue, Ball State, and Indiana universities. Reagan Kirk, the chair of Indiana University's Young Republicans Club, well, she's not into it.
It sends a message that IU would not cooperate with laws or policies that they don't agree with.
That's exactly what sanctuary campus proponents want. They say don't follow federal rules, protect students and staff from immigration authorities. A 2011 Indiana law bars cities and towns from declaring sanctuary status. And while lawmakers push a bill to include colleges and universities in that, others say it's just the declaration that's at stake here.
My perception of it at this point is that it's also mostly a kind of symbolic battle.
Shane Green teaches anthropology and Latin American studies at Indiana University. He led a faculty push for a sanctuary campus, but so far, no Indiana college or university has declared themselves sanctuary campus.
So why is there such concern about it, right? To try to sort of prevent it from happening or sort of put in place some sort of legislation that would sort of symbolically threaten universities.
University of Notre Dame, Purdue, Ball State, and Indiana University all declined interviews for this story. In a statement, an Indiana University spokesperson says the school won't voluntarily disclose anyone's citizenship status to federal authorities without a warrant. And recently, University of Notre Dame's president said the school would not be a sanctuary campus. In a February letter to staff, he said Notre Dame wouldn't share someone's citizenship status unless they were legally required to. But he said declaring sanctuary could draw unwanted attention from authorities, and there are better ways to protect students. In other words, judge me by what I do, not what I say.
Just because a school cannot declare itself a sanctuary does not mean that there's not many other ways it can support undocumented students.
Willie Palomo heads up Indiana University's Undocu-Hoosier Alliance. He says, sure, he'll judge schools by what they do. So he wants more from colleges than statements of support.
Better recruitment and retention programs for undocumented students, helping undocumented students who want to go to grad school find ways of piecing together these resources to make that possible.
Or staff positions and scholarship funds.
What's funny here is that universities aren't even willing to talk the talk right now. Like the most basic part of talking the talk, not even the doing part, but just the talking, would be declaring yourself a sanctuary at this point.
Because he says even as lawmakers consider outlawing sanctuary campuses, if a college won't publicly make a stand, how can you trust them to when it matters? For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Peter Ballinon-Rosen.
School City of East Chicago officials are confronting the financial issues that are connected with the loss of enrollment because of the city's lead contamination crisis. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore says that the superintendent's asking voters to dig a little deeper to help keep the schools open to preserve the progress that they've made in recent years.
Last year, school began in East Chicago with a crisis. The lead crisis that has impacted hundreds of families forced city officials to shut down Kerry Gosch Elementary School. The students needed a place to hold class, so they were moved into a shuttered school. School officials did that in 5 days. The state is working on a bill that will replace the funds used to deal with the impact of the crisis. State dollars follow the student, so without those students, they'll need to find a way to replace those funds. Dr. Paige McNulty is superintendent of the East Chicago Schools.
Yeah, so we've lost 401 kids and counting so far from our school, which we had 4,500 kids starting the school year. We're down to 4,100 students. So that's a revenue loss of over $3 million so far.
The answer is a referendum. They'll ask East Chicago residents to pay more to replace the funds that they have lost because of fewer students.
I think that when you have strong schools, you have a strong community. And when you have a strong community, you have strong schools. And so in order for us to continue to build our schools and make them strong, we have to have revenue and capital. One of the things that I'm proud of is we are investing back into our schools heavily with the new curriculum, new programming. So those are some of the reasons that I'm asking for the community to support our schools so that we can have our kids stay in our town and give back.
Dr. McNulty will be holding information sessions to sell the referendum to voters.
The things that we're doing, that we're putting in place to move our grades up are in place now. So the new curriculum, professional development for our staff. So every Wednesday is late start Wednesday in our school district now. Our staff is getting 4 hours a month of professional development on how to use the curriculum, on how to use instructional technology, those types of things. And I believe that we're well on our way to improving our programming.
In East Chicago, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
We look at studies like this as being kind of cliche busters. There are a lot of popular impressions about what type of places might attract young people to live, but sometimes those popular impressions aren't borne out by the facts. So we looked at eight different factors, eight things that are measurable and objective, ranging everything from economic factors to lifestyle type factors. And we kind of combined all those rankings to come up with an overall ranking of the best and worst states for millennials.
Well, let's take a look now at Indiana. What seem to be some of the best things for millennials as far as the data and the report is concerned?
As you know, of the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, Indiana came in at number 10, which is really strong to make the top 10. And some of the particular points of strength, Indiana was one of the top-ranked states for the availability of high-speed broadband. It also ranked in the top 10 for both the availability and the affordability of residential rentals. And that's something we consider significant for this study because most young adults are more likely to be renters than homeowners.
when you take a look at the data and you've looked at some positive points, what seem to be some negative points as far as Indiana is concerned for millennials?
Well, interestingly, the one area I would say that Indiana really fell down was it did not rate well in terms of the number of fitness facilities relative to the size of its young adult population. As I mentioned, we looked at a couple of lifestyle-related things along with the economic factors, and the concentration of fitness facilities was one of them. So if working out is your thing, Indiana might not be your top choice.
Now, since you have that topic to bring up, and we talk about the fact that there aren't quite as many fitness centers in Indiana to suit most millennials, I guess we talk about the problems of health issues. Do we find that maybe because of this lack of the number of healthcare facilities or health fitness facilities, rather, in Indiana, do you think that's going to cause a problem or is showing to cause a problem as far as millennials' health is concerned?
Not necessarily. I mean, lifestyle choices come down to a number of different things. This is also occupation is a big factor in personal health as well. But it's more just a question of giving people an indication, depending on what their personal priorities are, of what different states' strengths and weaknesses might be.
So it still looks pretty promising, I guess, for millennials, certainly in Indiana. And I know that we do see, of course, a shift of people living in other states coming to Indiana. In particular, we're talking about around Chicago and other parts of northern Illinois coming to live in Indiana. They like it, the conditions here for the most part. Certainly, if, like you say in the report, that millennials are interested in rentals. We need more of those, and I know that's certainly one of the things in the works that the housing markets here in Northwest Indiana are looking forward to. Is there anything else that you think that that maybe in a future report that you'll focus in on as far as millennials are concerned?
No, those are really, right now, some of the other things that we focused on that we haven't mentioned were the employment rate for young adults, the overall youthfulness of a state. Young people typically like to be around other young people, and the affordability of education, the cost of state schools for four-year degrees for in-state students. And Indiana came in around the middle of the pack on all of those issues, and so those neither kind of pulled it up or dragged it down.
We've been talking with Richard Barrington, who is with MoneyRates.com. The website's come out with some rankings for the best states for millennials to live in, and according to the new study, and Indiana ranks number 10 for many of these areas. Richard, thanks very much for being with us to tell us the information for the study, and we're looking forward to hearing back more and more reports here about how Indiana ranks and some of your future studies from MoneyRates.com. Thank you for being with us today.
Nice talking to you.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Methodist Hospitals and Franciscan Alliance are considering becoming Northwest Indiana's largest health care provider if the details can be worked out and if regulators approve the proposal. The president and CEO of the Gary-based Methodist Hospital System, Ray Grady, was with us on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk about the months-long process of finding a partner. What will now happen over the next few months based on the letter of intent that was signed by both systems, and what being part of the Franciscan Alliance system brings to the future of Northwest Indiana healthcare. Well, thanks very much, Mr. Grady, for being with us here on Regionally Speaking. Talk about the research and work that was done over the last few months about entering into such of a partnership between Franciscan Alliance and the Methodist Hospitals and how things are working out and what kind of benefit that Methodist Hospital System is going to get in better serving the communities.
Okay, I'd be happy to do that. Well, first of all, as you may recall, we spoke about several months ago about the reasons why hospitals want to be involved in consolidating with other organizations.
Oh, yes.
And at that time, we mentioned that hospitals were consolidating because they wanted to achieve access to capital. They wanted to expand their base of physicians. They wanted to prepare for healthcare reform and a number of other reasons in terms of improving their costs. About a year ago, our board made the decision that a strategic partnership would probably make sense as a part of our long-term strategic plan. When we made that decision, we looked at the external environment, and we noticed that more and more hospitals in the state of Illinois were consolidating and giving up their independent status to join larger systems for all the reasons that hospitals do that these days. There's over 200 hospitals in the state of Illinois, and most of them are now affiliated with parts of systems. If you look at the state of Indiana, we have about 130 hospitals in the state of Indiana, and about half of those are members of a larger healthcare system. And as we looked to the field and to see what was going on, we decided that we would go out and conduct a evaluation of all those hospitals or networks that might be interested in partnering with us in a consolidated fashion. We received expressions of interest from about 17 different hospitals. Some of them were community hospitals, some were teaching hospitals, some were for-profit hospitals. And we narrowed that down to three local hospital systems, and then we narrowed it down to one. And the one that we chose was basically an affiliation with Franciscan, because we thought it would be a good path forward for us in terms of being prepared to be successful in a healthcare reform environment. And the reason we chose Franciscan out of all of those was for two reasons. First of all, Franciscan was the only one that was willing to make a commitment to the Gary community, to our mission in Gary of making sure that no patient gets left behind when it comes to access to care. And they were willing to make financial investments in improving and enhancing services in the Gary community. They were also willing, the only ones that were willing to work collaboratively with us to fashion an agreement with the Office of Civil Rights to make sure that whatever model we came up with for working together met the spirit of the consent decree that was signed in 1975 that assures that healthcare services remain in the Gary community. The second reason we chose Franciscan was because we felt they were a good path forward for us in terms of meeting the triple aim of healthcare, that is improving the patient experience, improving our costs, and improving patient outcomes. What Methodist gets out of this relationship and what we're looking for in this relationship with Franciscan is, number one, it allows us to really expand our base of primary care and specialists. If we remain independent, we're going to have to do that, but it's much easier to do that as a part of a larger system. As a part of a larger system, we get to be a part of a larger geographic footprint. That larger geographic footprint really allows us to have more contract options when it comes to the purchases of care, the insurance companies, and to have some additional input in the negotiation of rates in that regard. It also allows us access to some new payment models that we can't achieve on our own, specifically as it relates to being a part of an accountable care payment model or being prepared to accept bundle payments for episodes of care. We can do that better as a part of a larger organization. It's an opportunity for us to improve our costs and to eliminate duplication of costs across the system that we would be a part of. And as I said before, it allows us to, in my opinion, really focus on improving the quality of care that we provide to the patients in Northwest Indiana. Now,
Mr. Grady, take a moment and give our listeners an opportunity to get in your mind and others' minds and going through the process now over the next 4 to 6 months now this non-binding letter of intent has been announced as to the process of what's going to happen that's going to smooth things along to create the what I know some call a merger and certainly is certainly combining of services and a partnership that you and Francis, you representing Methodist Hospitals, and Franciscan Alliance are going to work on.
Okay. Basically, what this letter of intent is, it's a letter of good intent. What it does is mean, what it means is that we will enter into exclusive discussions over the next 4 to 6 months to see if we can work out a definitive agreement that would allow our organizations to come together. As a part of that letter of intent, we would go through an intense due diligence where they would look at all of our data, and we would look at all of their data, all of our contracts, and we would look at all of their contracts. And it's like buying a house. It's like doing due diligence when you buy a house. When you buy a house, you have to go out there and get a home inspection. You have to make sure your buyers are qualified. Our due diligence is no different in many ways to what you do when you're buying a home. But it will also allow us an opportunity to explore the development of a new hospital and new scopes of services within the Methodist system. It'll give us an opportunity to look at what we will do with the existing campus that we have here in Gary if we do agree to build a new hospital in the Gary community. It will allow us to focus on the expansion of the South Lake campus in a thoughtful way. One of the things that we'll have to do during due diligence is to make sure that we create what I would call a clinical rationalization plan so that we'll have centers of excellence at certain hospitals and we'll have core basic services at all of the hospitals. Well, we need to have that clinical rationalization plan to really understand exactly what services we're going to provide to what patients and what communities and where we could develop centers of excellence at each of the hospitals within the new system. As a part of a Catholic system, obviously we have to comply with the ethical and religious directives of the Catholic Church, and those directives characterize the type and the scope of healthcare services that are permissible or contrary to the mission of the Catholic healthcare organization, especially as it relates to the right to life issues. Mm-hmm. And we have to figure out what that all means for us and how we go about complying with that, because as a part of this arrangement, we would basically be held accountable for abiding with those ethical and religious directives of the Catholic healthcare systems.
So you see there's going to be quite a bit of work in the next few months here, as you say, to compare and contrast and make sure that everything is going to blend well in this partnership. It's not an easy task, I would imagine.
That's correct.
When you take a look at some of the specifics, and we know there are a lot of details that will be worked out here going into such a partnership with the Franciscan Alliance, will this mean that the Methodist hospitals and the affiliated clinics are going to be renamed to become the Franciscan or something of that sort? Or are you going to find some combination of that?
Well, basically, this is a full asset merger. Mm-hmm. Basically, what it means is that Franciscan Alliance would acquire Methodist hospitals, all of our debt, all of our obligations, all of our revenue, and we would basically be a part of their system. If we follow their current brand strategy, you'd have Franciscan Gary and you'd have Franciscan Merrillville. Mm-hmm. And then we'd have to look at expanded investments in both of the local communities that we're serving here in terms of Gary as well as Merrillville.
Now, this agreement obviously is going to have some regulatory approval to become official. Which agencies are going to have to look over all of this information and sign off on it before it becomes official?
Yeah, that's a good question and an important one. There are a number of key stakeholders that we have to manage as a part of getting to a definitive agreement. Obviously, one of them is the Federal Trade Commission. They will have to approve any merger between our two organizations to make sure that there are no antitrust violations created by the merger of the two systems. We have to make sure that whatever deal we arrive at, it meets the review of the Office of Civil Rights in Chicago, which oversees the consent decree, because that's going to be important to get the approval of the Office of Civil Rights to move ahead with what we want to do. Obviously, we have to make sure that the mayor of the city of Gary is signed on to this, as well as some key stakeholders in the city in terms of Mayor Hatcher and Charlie Brown, our representatives, the original architects of the consent decree. And so we're going to have to make sure that we include all of those individuals in our discussions before we reach a final agreement.
Do you have any discussions that you have to do or sign off on here from any representatives of the town of Merrillville?
Yeah, what we're going to do is we'll keep everybody in the community updated over the next 120 days on exactly what we're going to do. And when we started this process, as a matter of fact, I touched base with all of those stakeholders, including the mayor of Merrillville, to update them on the decisions that we were making and the directions and the things that we were thinking about in terms of assuring that these two communities continue to have care. Mm-hmm. Healthcare in the future.
Okay. Well, you've talked in the past, and you've alluded to some here in the first of our conversation here about the changing healthcare landscape here in Northwest Indiana and the need to be able to adapt to it. And do you feel that with this partnership going through, in your opinion, that the residents and providers also are going to be in a much better position for the future?
Oh, Absolutely, and I think that that's true in a number of ways. First of all, I think that you will see immediately you'll see an improvement in access to care, because there'll be more care sites for individuals to choose to go and get their care in the future. I think that the patients who are seen in our system will have access to more physicians and more locations for care, especially those that now receive their care at both Gary and Merrittville. I think it'll be an opportunity for us to standardize care across the region and thereby improve the safety and efficacy of care. If we are going to be truly an integrated delivery system and a part of a larger system like Franciscan, there's a real opportunity, I think, to be absolutely certain that we can standardize care across all the hospitals so that any patient that enters any of the hospitals in our system can be assured the same quality of care no matter where they go and the same quality of experience no matter which hospital that they choose to go to. It'll give us an opportunity to collectively, on a much broader scale, reduce disparities of care in terms of the access to care in the Northwest Indiana area. And it'll give us an opportunity to focus on population health, which is a very popular topic mm-hmm. in healthcare today. And population health basically allows us to suggest that we need to focus on preventive healthcare services instead of inpatient healthcare services. And under a population health model, we want to be able to take care of a broad geographic group of patients and assume risk for those patients and the care that we provide to those patients. And being a part of a larger system allows us to do a better job of that in the future.
We've been speaking with Ray Grady, who is the president and CEO of Methodist Hospitals. Lublin, Poland, 1797. While they prepare for Passover, a family of Jewish women klezmer musicians struggles for survival. But when music and love prove not enough, only the unthinkable can save them. Tune in this evening at 7 o'clock for Witches of Lublin, here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Wallet Hub, the online analyst of money across the nation and how we spend it, put out a recent analysis of the United States tax landscape, a very, very close look at the states that have the best and the worst taxpayer return for investment in 2017. And analyst Jill Gonzalez with Wallet Hub is with us to give us how Indiana fared in this. Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, fill us in here, if you will. How did Indiana fare? I guess we did pretty well. Of all the states in the nation, came out number 20. Tell us how Wallet Hub ranked everybody and the data that they used to come up with the rankings.
We first, of course, looked at the total taxes paid in Indiana. We did that on a per capita basis and then compared it to the overall government services that people in Indiana get. So basically, what kind of bang for their buck are they getting? And we looked at that across the board, of course, and things like education, healthcare, safety, the overall economy, and finally infrastructure. And Indiana, as you said, did pretty well, top 20. I mean, this is a necessary evil here, taxes. So considering that, it did pretty well, especially in the education and economy rankings, where it could do a little bit better when it comes to healthcare and safety.
Now, you talk about how, of course, the tax dollars are spent. Do you think some of that, maybe you discovered this in some other states as well, too, was because of Indiana's rather conservative ranking and what they use their money for?
I mean, yes and no. When we're mm-hmm. looking here at things like education, we see that Indiana has good marks across the board from everything from the public university system, public high school, graduation rate, school systems as well. When it comes to healthcare, two things are a problem here, accessibility and quality, so the quality of public hospital systems as well.
Our state legislature is going to propose raising the gasoline tax in Indiana by a dime a gallon to raise enough funds to help do a lot of major infrastructure work. There are a lot of beat-up roads and bridges across the Hoosier State, and we note as well, too, that it's going to have some money to be able to get some of that work done. So Indiana is going to have to make some tough decisions on raising taxes in some respects, and do you think that maybe Indiana, in this case, would be in better stead than some other states? I know that some states have many, many more beat-up roads than we do. One in particular, I would note that Nebraska had the lowest percentage, proportion rather, of major roads in poor condition, but I'm sure that there's some other states that have some worse conditions.
That's right. Indiana, there's about 15% of major roads that are in poor condition that need work. bridges more like 20%. So those, again, were top 20 numbers. Could be a little bit better across the board, but at least you know that there is a plan in place to hopefully turn those numbers around even further.
Now, you mentioned in the survey that one of the categories looked into closely here, besides health and the economy and education, was safety here. How does Indiana rank as far as the data that the Wallet Hub did looking into how safe Hoosiers really are these days?
It did okay. I mean, as far as the violent and property crime rates, both could be a little bit better. Property crime rate is pretty much middle of the pack. It ranked 25th out of all 50 states plus D.C. Violent crime rate, though, is toward the bottom here. It ranked 31st. So that could be, obviously, a little bit lower, and that a lot of it has to do with policing changes, and, of course, more efficient spending to police districts across the state.
Do you think that the data and putting things together, Jill, that it turns out that Indiana has some advantages over its neighboring states here in the Midwest, and in turn, on the other hand, maybe could learn some lessons from them?
Absolutely. So we did see a little bit of some regional trends here. As far as the Midwest, Indiana did do pretty well. Ohio beat it out by one and ranked 19th. Mm-hmm. Indiana, we said, was 20th. But there are some states that have gotten a little bit more expensive as far as taxes are concerned, and those, of course, would not fare as well here.
And when you get all this information together, and the report's out there, by the way, if you go onto the Wallet Hub website and find out how Indiana and other states ranked in the best and the worst taxpayer return for investment, do you think that there's some information that our lawmakers can possibly pull out of some of this if they took a look at the information?
Absolutely. You know, the reason that we put this together is really to show not only residents but local authorities and local officials exactly where their state can use improvement, be it education, be it healthcare system, et cetera. So we are hoping that these people can use this to further make that spending efficient in years to come.
Jill Gonzalez is an analyst for WalletHub.com. We've been looking at the latest ranking of the states with the best and the worst taxpayer return for their investment as far as tax dollars are concerned. Indiana ranking number 20, about halfway in the pack, so to speak. Jill, thanks very much for being with us to talk about this, and look forward to another Wallet Hub survey coming out soon.
Anytime.
And on this Monday, it's time to hear from John Kane of South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Jay Giannotti, who is president of the board of the Genesius Guild. I've heard of the Genesius Guild forever. It's one of the older established community theaters in Northwest Indiana.
We've been around, this is our 32nd or 33rd year we're doing this year.
Okay. And I've seen some of your productions over the years. I saw, sometimes you used to perform at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in Munster, where I work. But where do you typically perform now?
Our permanent home is at the First United Methodist Church of Hammond, Indiana, 6635 Holman Avenue.
Yeah, that's right. I've seen shows there as well. So how did you get involved, Jay?
I first appeared on stage in a play there 5-6 years ago, I guess it's been. So I'm a relative newcomer to the Guild, so to speak. So I've been there. I've been kind of doing things on and off for a few years after that, then been coming more and more involved the last few years.
Have you? Do you have some people who have been involved for a really long time?
Well, obviously, the obvious people are Larry Hinken and Ed Griffith, who have unfortunately passed along in recent years, people know about. Ken Mertens is another longtime member that's been there.
Uh-huh.
We've had a lot of influx of younger, newer people, which is good to see.
Oh, that's great.
Especially, you know, with Larry and Ed not being with us anymore, mm-hmm. having a younger group, so to speak, coming in and sort mm-hmm. of becoming a bigger part of what we do there is good to see.
So your next show is called The God Committee.
Yes.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, basically, it's set in a hospital boardroom. It's a group of doctors and nurses, and a heart is potentially coming up for a transplant, and they have to decide who among three potential patients is the best suited or most deserving of this new heart.
Mm-hmm.
It takes place in real time, takes place entirely in this boardroom, and the doctors and nurses go back and forth and decide which of these people is the best person to get the heart.
And how is the play formatted? Is it a situational kind of thing with characters being played within the setting of the hospital?
Exactly. Like I said, it's entirely in the boardroom, so it happens in real time. It's very fast paced. It's probably like 75, 80 minutes in total.
Do you have blood and gore?
No blood and gore.
Like on TV?
No, nothing like that.
I have to hold my hand up when those scenes mm-hmm. come up.
But it's a very fascinating play because you get to see the doctors, the nurses, you know, discuss the patients, what their circumstances are, their backgrounds are in real time, and how they use those to kind of make their decisions. And not only do they debate the actual patients themselves, but also the doctors and nurses themselves have their own sort of biases and experiences that relate in some way to these patients. So they kind of had to work with their biases in terms of, are they even prepared or emotionally able to make the correct decision or the best decision?
So I can remember seeing Anything Goes as a Genesius production at the Art Center in Munster 20 years ago, maybe. This is quite different than that.
Yes.
This is a serious, more intimate play, I suspect.
It's intimate. And typically our spring shows are what we call our black box shows. They are more the smaller, intimate types of shows.
Okay.
But we're also looking at some interesting things to do to get some of the audience not necessarily more interactive, but get them close to the action. Like we even talked about possibly even putting some seats on the stage itself. So really getting people close to the action, kind of make them feel they're in the same room with the actors.
So
the doctors make a decision.
Observe the heart surgery, as it were.
Or the decision.
The decision, yeah, I get it. You're not going to actually perform open heart surgery.
I certainly hope not. It's
no. How many shows do you do a year?
We typically do 4 shows a season. We just finished our first show this season. We just finished about a month ago, Guys and Dolls.
That's what kind of thing I would have
seen.
But that's good. You have to stretch yourself and you have to do a variety of things.
We try to do a good mix of shows. We try to balance. We typically do 2 musicals and 2 plays a year. And even within that, we try to balance. You know, we do a comedy or a big comedy, then do a smaller drama maybe. And so we try to, when we set our seasons out, we try to mix up what we do and make sure we get a good balance.
And everything is run by volunteers.
That is correct.
Yeah. How large is the board?
Currently, we have 13 members on our board currently.
Mm-hmm. So what are your plans for upcoming shows?
Well, like I said, the God Committee, that opens April 28th. That runs for 2 weekends. You can call and get tickets at our ticket line at 877-724-7715.
And what follows the God Committee?
This summer, we're hoping to do Once Upon a Mattress, which is another musical comedy.
Sure. I know it well. Mm-hmm. Carol Burnett.
The original.
She was the star.
The original Winifred, yes.
Yes, with the P under her mattress
exactly.
That she could feel. All right. Well, Jay, good luck with the God Committee. And it really does sound like an interesting production and one that will help to stretch your actors and your company.
We hope so. Thank you.
That's great. Yeah, thanks for being here. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
This is John Kane, the host of Eye on the Arts, talking with Jay Giannotti about the upcoming play, The God Committee. Tune in next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. What do you call a sirloin patty with garlic butter, blue cheese dressing, and other fixings? A burger named for Gene Cady. Yeah, Gene Cady, the retired Purdue University basketball coach, has his own burger at the Route 66 Diner in West Lafayette. It's called Coach Cady's Jamaica Me Crazy Burger. It costs you $9.65 if you buy it there at the diner. Cady says he always wondered why Purdue coaches didn't have their own sandwiches at the diner. The Lafayette Journal and Courier reports that Cady's wife created the burger, which includes Jamaican jerk seasoning. Kathleen Petrie Cady says her husband, sometimes, as she put it, is a jerk, but I'd love him to death. That's it for Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks very much for being with us. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you tomorrow.